Blog Talk Radio.
Just so you know, that was not a chicken. Chickens have been retired. Good evening and welcome to Eerie House Radio. I'm Dale Kay from Spook Show, here along with
Dave Binkley from The Weirdest Really Bad Movie.
Is it really bad?
Sometimes it's terrible.
You've done some good movies. You've done some good ones.
Oh, we have. You know, I really like the murder mystery ones, the old murder mysteries that we get to share. Those are some of my favorites, I think. But Dale, I can't see you anywhere. Dale, where are you?
I'm invisible and I'm on radio, so that's like double whammy.
Double whammy. Yes, as we're finishing off our Battle of the Invisibles this weekend, but we don't have the Shadow or the Avenger tonight.
No, but we have something really, really, really good. You know, renowned author H.G. Wells wrote a great story about invisibility that, of course, inspired a wonderful Universal flick starring Claude Rains called The Invisible Man. All right?
Yep.
But that's
yep.
not what we have for you today.
No. No, 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 no. It's another show. You know, before we actually get into what the story is, I want to tell you, I'm so amazed looking back at H.G. Wells and Jules Verne and these guys talking about things that wouldn't come about. I mean, talking about submarines and planes and rocket ships before they were even imagined. It just,
yeah.
To me, I mean, the story we're looking at tonight, which isn't about that, but it's really about a fourth dimension. And nobody was even thinking anything beyond the three dimensions that we have right now. Yeah, but that's where H.G. Wells was in 1897 when he wrote this particular story.
Yeah, I honestly, I'm not familiar with the story at all. As much as I've read and enjoyed some of the classic H.G. Wells pieces of literature, and I'm not suggesting the story is not, it's just something I've not been exposed to yet. Watcher
well,
of the Living.
Well, and you know what's interesting about that? Well, this was Watcher of the Living, and is the name of our story. But at the beginning, we'll find out from the Mystery Theater when E.G. Marshall, we'll get enough initials in here to really confuse everybody. When E.G. Marshall comes in here, he will tell us at the beginning that this is a story that had never been adapted for any media format outside of its original print form before. That's amazing. And still,
it is.
Even after this was from 1979 when this was made, and even since that time, there's been no other adaptation of this story.
Yeah.
They did such a fine job adapting it. Yeah, just, you know, he had so many great works. I don't know, would you call this a lesser work? I mean, you're going to have to tell me at the end of this broadcast, because I don't really, I don't see how it can be. It's thoughtful, like I said. He's talking about a fourth dimension when nobody was even conceiving a fourth dimension. You know, there are times, Dan, when I wonder when people like this, let me put it this way, I always thought of writing a story called The Very Last Ben Franklin Interview. And what it is this guy is interviewing Ben Franklin in Philadelphia, just maybe a week or so before Ben finally passes. And he talks about all his things and all his things he's done. He says, I'm just the guy who just tinkered with some things, and that's it. And after the interview, he goes back in the back and kind of taps on his time machine from the future, and kind of wonders whatever happened to his friends because it broke down. Something happened that it worked, but it broke down, and he couldn't replace the part. And he was stuck in that time. He wondered what happened to his friends of Jules Verne and H.G. Wells and those likes. You know, but having an insight from the future is almost the only way I think you could possibly conceive of some of the things that they did.
And perhaps maybe this story in particular didn't become as well-known and well-read as many of H.G. Wells' other stories, is perhaps the subject was too deep for that audience of that day. He was such a visionary with his suppositions of the future and his writings of how things might come to pass. And, you know, he wrote great adventurous stories, but yet stories that made you think about the future.
I mean, it's true. This is not going to rival War of the Worlds. It will not and cannot. Well, that doesn't make it a bad story, as we will see tonight, you know. But the Invisible Man, can it rival the Invisible Man? I don't know. I mean, I think this was more of a short story than a full novel. But still, you know, they've taken full novels and turned them into our presentations elsewhere in time before. So it could have been, but as far as I know, this was one of more of the short stories and not the full novels. And he is so well known for his full novels that most people even think of his short stories. It's kind of like Charles Dickens, or not Charles Dickens, but Conan Doyle. You know, everybody, when you say Conan Doyle, what's the first thing you think about?
Lost World, myself.
Well, okay. So you're in the minority. Most everybody thinks of Sherlock Holmes.
Yes.
Then there's Lost World, where, and think, Dale, every year we seem to find things that nobody either thought existed or still existed. That's the future that Conan Doyle saw with that. But everybody thinks of Sherlock Holmes, and they don't think of his many, many, many other short stories, which is kind of why he tired of Sherlock Holmes and actually killed him off at one point, but had to go back to it just because the public demand was just so strong for it.
And you got to pay the bills.
Right. And not that the other stories weren't good and didn't sell, but they certainly didn't sell like Sherlock Holmes did. And maybe that's, you know, what happened to today's story. I think it's a wonderful story, very interesting. And again, thinking that this was presented in 1979, but it was a story that was made in 1897. And that's what we have to think about as we're listening to the story, I think.
Yeah, 92 years later, after it was written, finally put to a medium other than the written page. And let's see how our listening audience, which, by the way, includes Fogsbane, they're live in the chat, plus the others that we can't see. Glad you could get in. It's been locking up for him, and I think a few other people lately. So fear not. We've got a great story, and we want to see how you feel. Would this make a great story in an anthology series? I think so. I haven't heard it yet, but I've done some research finally today for today's show, and a little more in depth, and read a nice synopsis of the story, so I don't want to ruin it if you haven't heard it before. But I want to see if you agree with me. Would this make a nice segment in an anthology series like The Outer Limits or Twilight Zone or something like that?
Well, that's a question let's ask out at the end of the program.
Yeah, that's right. And from March 7th of 1979, here's part one of three of CBS Radio Mystery Theater's Watcher of
the CBS Radio Mystery Theater presents Marshall, probably the greatest English writer of the last century who wrote with two words in mind, could be, is the novelist H.G. Wells. Wells has lifted our imaginations with The First Man on the Moon, The War of the Worlds, The Invisible Man, and so on. With extraordinary resourcefulness and creativity, he has brought life to the incredible. And today we have taken his words from the page and placed them in your ear so that you may actually believe you are in the outlandish world of H.G. Wells.
Professor Lidget, can you make out the school desks and the school children?
Yes, I can. And I do.
From here, they look phosphorescent. Luminous, don't they?
They do look strange, Platner. And that explosion blew us a considerable distance away. I must get back to the school and take charge.
Oh, Professor Lidget, I don't think that'll be possible.
Why not, indeed?
Because I think that you and I are dead.
Our mystery drama, Watchers of the Living, adapted from a story by H.G. Wells, was written especially for the Mystery Theater by James Agate Jr. and stars Tony Roberts. I'll be back shortly with Act One.
Come in.
Oh, great master, I have traveled far to seek your wisdom. Speak to me.
Close the door, it's cold.
Sir, I crave the meaning of life.
How do you earn your bread, my son?
Well...
Do you till the soil?
No.
Do you tend sheep?
I'm in advertising, sir.
Advertising. Fascinating.
Yes, sir, I'm in a big hurry. I have to be in Fiji tomorrow to shoot a television commercial.
Fiji?
Yeah, we found a place there that looks exactly like Columbus, Ohio.
Why not go to Columbus, Ohio?
Look, I'm just here for some wisdom.
All right,
sir.
Let me check my wisdom book, see what we can
thank
find.
Thank you, yeah.
Go with radio.
What?
Looks to me like a fantastic buy.
I wanted important wisdom.
This is important. Listen, newspaper cost per thousand is up 99% since 1967. TV is up 90%.
Sir.
But radio cost is only up 38%.
38%.
And it says radio's audience is bigger than ever.
But what about happiness and stuff?
Use radio. It's great impact at a price you can still afford, and you'll be very happy.
That's it?
Yeah. And when you go out, close the door real tight, because
it's
cold in here and I got a runny nose.
If you want to talk to an authority on advertising, call us. We're 97 WFLA.
What'll it be this time, Mr. Wells? Mars colliding with Earth? A machine to put you into another century? The problems of loving and living when no one can see you? None of the above? Something completely different? Yes. It is. In fact, in the 90 years of science fiction that followed where H.G. Wells blazed the trail, no one has ever attempted to duplicate the story we tell you now.
My name is Fred Platner. I'm 27. My mother and father passed away when I was 10. I'm a teacher at a small school in Sussexville. So small that one teacher has to do the work of five. Too much work for too little pay. Last week, I heard of a great summer job in town, lifeguard on Sandy Beach. To apply, I first had to get a physical checkup.
Mr. Platner, I do not have good news for you.
I'm sick, Dr. Bender?
No, I wouldn't say that. Not sick, but strange.
You mean when you examined me, you found some...
I didn't want to say anything until I had the x-rays, but I can tell you this. In all my years of general practice, I have never seen a body like yours.
Well, will I live?
Who knows? Before I show you the x-rays, tell me, young man, why do you want to be a lifeguard? I understand you have an eminently scholarly position as a teacher.
Well, that's what everyone tells me, Doctor. But there's no money in it now and no future in it tomorrow.
What do you teach?
What don't I teach? Bookkeeping, geography, modern languages, and chemistry, which Dr. Lidget, our former principal, threw at me about a month ago.
My, all those subjects. You must have a vast knowledge.
No, I don't. But since my students begin by knowing nothing, all I have to do is bone up from day to day and stay one lesson ahead.
What an extraordinary way to run a school.
In a town of 1,000 persons and 1 1/4 children per household, I was told by Professor Lidgett, the principal, there was no alternative. There are 2 other teachers besides myself, and that's it. On my present salary, I can hardly save a cent. But if I pass the physical and get this lifeguard position, I could clear $300 this summer.
I wish I could help you, Mr. Plattner, but the facts don't help me. Let me show you. Look at these, your x-rays. First, notice your heart beats on the right side of your body. Now look at this plate. That is the right lobe of your liver. However, it's on the left side, and the left lobe is on the right side. Tell me, have you noticed any changes in yourself lately?
Well, now that you mention it, I have been finding it sort of difficult to write straight across a page the way I used to.
You've stopped writing? How do you correct papers?
Using my left hand and writing across the paper from right to left.
Anything else, Mr. Plattner, out of the ordinary?
Well, I was never very good at sports, but now I can't throw a ball with my right hand at all.
With your left?
Not far. And sometimes I get confused at mealtimes, trying to find my knife and fork. I've caught myself quite often trying to cut my meat with my fork and putting it into my mouth with my knife. I'm backwards, is that it?
What should be on your right side is on your left.
You're sure I haven't always been that way?
I asked myself the same question. So I got out your old x-rays from Dr. Jonas's files. The last time you came for a checkup, everything was in its proper place.
I wonder.
I have a theory, Mr. Plattner, which is not easy to substantiate, how this might have occurred to a person, but my theory could hardly apply to you.
It couldn't?
There's a mathematical hypothesis that the only way a solid body can be changed is by taking that body clean out of space, as we know it, and inverting it.
Oh, my gosh.
Much further into space than any astronauts have ever gone, of course. Into the fourth dimension, in fact. But that is a theory, and you, Mr. Plattner, are a fact. Obviously, your internal exchange of left for right was not the result of any voyages into the fourth dimension.
Oh, but they are. I mean, they could be.
You have made such a trip?
I have. I was hoping to keep it a secret.
My dear young man, look, getting a job this summer as a lifeguard isn't that important.
Oh, but I did. 2 weeks ago. I mean, I returned from wherever I was 2 weeks ago. Didn't you hear about my disappearing from the school? You see, that's where I must have been. In that fourth dimension.
Mr. Plattner, you're not feeling chilly or flushed, are you?
No, I'm fine.
So you took a trip into space, did you?
Well, I don't know where I was, but I certainly wasn't in Sussexville.
Mr. Plattner, I imagine the tests have been a bit exhausting, so if you'll come into the next room, you just stretch out on this couch, close your eyes, and rest up a bit.
But I'm not tired.
For your own sake, I think lying down won't hurt. You know, when you speak of traveling to other dimensions, even if you can't be a lifeguard this summer, I'd hate you to lose your teaching job because they thought you've lost your mind.
Of course, I couldn't really blame Dr. Bandiner for thinking somehow I'd become unscrewed. And as I lay down in his anteroom, those 9 days in nowhere came back to me. 9 days I'd never forget. It began on a Tuesday night after chemistry class.
Why are you still here, Plattner? The bell rang. What are all these boys still doing here? They haven't all been kept in, have they?
Professor Lidgett, Carson here found some green powder up in the old lime kiln. So So I told the boys if they'd like to take part in some scientific research, stay after class, and we'll subject the green powder to some scientific tests.
Proceed then, Platner. I shall watch with interest. You don't mind if I stand beside you at the table here?
No, not at all. Professor Lidgett, we're conducting this experiment to impress upon these boys, Jacoby, Goodman, O'Shea, and Carson, that curiosity is not something that should stop after one has left school. So, here is a medicine bottle containing green powder, courtesy of Billy Carson, and plugged with a masticated piece of newspaper.
Plugged with what?
A large spitball. First, we place a small amount of the green powder into a test tube. We hold the tube under the tap and see what effect is caused by water. No effect. No change in the substance whatsoever. As you can see, the powder does not even dissolve. Now, we'll prepare a number of test tubes, filling them with a little of Carson's green powder, partially filling each, and then in turn we'll test the green powder against nitric acid, sulfuric acid, hydrochloric acid. Very disappointing. No results, no changes in the powder. The experiment has yielded us zero. Nix. Naught. Well, boys, those are the hazards of science.
Why don't you set fire to some of the powder, Platinum?
Light it? With a match.
Or a Bunsen burner.
Boys, our principal, Professor Lidgett, suggests a test by fire. Here we go. We knock a few grains from the bottle onto this slate on our lab table. Professor, would you oblige with a match?
Oh, yes, happy to.
It's smoking. The green powder is melting. At the explosion, I was lifted off my feet and driven forcibly backwards. I wondered if I'd crashed through the wall or window of the chemistry lab. The next thing I knew, I was thrown to the ground.
Platner, is that you?
Professor Lidgett, are you hurt?
Well, I don't think so.
Me neither. My face seems to be all right. I still have both my ears, hands, arms, and my feet.
Oh, so I thank heaven. Where's the school? Where are we? None of this countryside looks familiar to me.
Look, straight in front of us. Those figures. I know those boys. They're in my bookkeeping class. But how strange they look. Sort of gray and amorphous. Almost floating.
Are those gray shapes there? Those are our students?
I can see their lips move. They're talking. But I can't hear a word they're saying. And they're coming towards us. The one in front is Johnson. Great heavens. He just walked right through you.
I know. And I didn't feel a thing. Did you notice how dark it is getting? Above us, the sky is jet black. The only light is that greenish glow on the horizon and those black hills. Where are we?
Well, I can still see the chemistry classroom, but it seems to be receding, getting fainter.
I can see it, too. Way off there. It's as though I had X-ray eyes and can see right through the walls. We must get back. We've been blown a considerable distance away. I must take charge.
Well, I doubt that that will be possible, sirs. As I analyze it, A, no one sees us. B, no one hears us. C, the boys walk right through us. D, yet we appear whole and uninjured. E, to ourselves we are real, but the school seems unreal. Therefore, I would conclude, ergo...
What?
That you and I, Professor, are dead.
Well now, have we just heard from the living, or should I say, speaking dead? How's that for a first act curtain? The shape of things to come. Things beyond have always intrigued man. If, as some philosophers believe, ours is the world of the dying, then the next could possibly be the world of the living. What it's like, we may find out when I return shortly with Act Two.
The city, full of architectural barriers that keep disabled citizens out of public buildings. My job, I'm a barrier cop. Barrier Central.
It's about the elevator in the library. You can't feel the floor numbers with your fingertips.
Uh-huh. Barrier to blind people. We'll get it fixed.
Thank you.
It's my job. I'm a barrier cop.
This story could be true. Only the barriers can be changed to protect your rights. For information on how to file complaints, write Access America, Washington, D.C., 20201.
And we're lowering the barriers of boredom. Here with a very good, very, very good story from CBS Radio Mystery Theater.
You know, I got to thinking, Dale, that maybe one of the reasons that the story has just kind of been left behind. Think of when Rod Serling in 1959 proposed the Twilight Zone and said there, in his opening narration, there is a fifth dimension. And people think are asking, what the heck happened to the fourth dimension? Where are you getting the fifth from?
yeah.
So the fact is, even in 59, most people couldn't even imagine there being a fourth dimension. So 100 years, darn near, well, at that point, what, 80 years or so before that, you know, they're certainly not going to be able to even comprehend what he's talking about with a fourth dimension.
Yeah, that's kind of, I was hoping that I was alluding to that earlier, because it's kind of a good story to have gotten away for that long, for 92 years before. You know, again, outside of the, not to downplay the written page at all. I love to read. Don't have time. But this is an interesting story. I mean, here they're speculating they're in the afterlife or something.
Yes, they may think that they're half speculating that they're dead.
Yeah.
So it's I think it's interesting. Here's a little bit on the. On the mystery theater that we hadn't really presented before, as the program was pitched, at least initially, to an audience old enough to remember classic radio. Hyman Brown was a legend amongst radio drama enthusiasts for his work on Inner Sanctum Mysteries, The Adventures of Nero Wolfe, and other shows dating back to the 1930s. Even young characters in early episodes of CBS Radio Mystery Theater tended to have names popular with a generation earlier, such as Jack, George, Phyllis, and Mary. Many scripts, especially those by Ian Martin, showed a tin ear for the 70s youth slang. Don't let her give you the runaround, Dad. I think, I was in quotes, and I think being around here is going to be kicks. Another quote. Another quote is, I dig a man who's far out. As late as 1981, Sam Dan's scripts, who probably wrote more of the mystery theaters than anyone else, included uncomfortable or skeptical references to women's lib, a term that was by then around a decade out of date. In short, Brown made no attempt to broaden the program's appeal beyond the older generation that it had been raised on radio, but that was his target audience. Now, one other side note, the debut of the CBS Radio Mystery Theater was only a few months after the American Graffiti phenomenon, coinciding with the 1950s nostalgia fad that swept young America during the mid-1970s and the program quickly developed a large fan base among young listeners in addition to its older target audience.
Yeah, you mentioned, and I forget who it was, CBS Radio Mystery Theater is basically just a reset of the old radio shows. Well, yes, exactly.
And that is exactly what it was, and that was exactly Hammond Brown's plan. His plan was to bring more drama to the radio than any particular program brought in a week of network radio. And in a sense it was, because throughout the week of the radio you had mostly comedies and some anthology programs and dramas and stuff, but mostly what you had was your comedies and whatever else that went along with it. But as far as, Suspense was only on for half an hour a week, and Escape during the same time was on for half an hour a week. At its heyday, they weren't giving 7 hours a week of drama.
Yeah.
And that was his goal here.
Yeah, and well done. I mean, I have not been disappointed by any, Dave. When you promote these and say that these are going to be a good story, like I said, you haven't missed yet. I've looked forward to actually hearing it after doing the research, even more than from when you described it. And we're going to have part two come up here in just a second.
Yeah, and the wonderful music there. Actually, a good deal of the music on this particular show was from The Twilight Zone. How that happened was Rod Serling had this music that paid to have this music made for Twilight Zone, but when Twilight Zone ended, and his wife, that's the one thing his wife probably never forgave him for, he sold all his interest to CBS, because it was kind of a joint venture between Rod and CBS, and he sold his entire half of it to CBS for just under $1 million, and it's been estimated that it's been worth well over $1 billion, because since it's been off the air, it's been somewhere, especially with the proliferation of cable channels, it's been somewhere on this planet every day. And it's been worth well over $1 billion of what he technically gave away for well under $1 million back when he gave up rights in 1965. But this music, this particular piece that they use as the theme music, is from the episode 2 that starred, I think it was Charles Bronson and Elizabeth Montgomery. And it was written directly for that. And I think it's like a minute 13 into the original score, and I have most of the Twilight Zone soundtracks that were released. And that's about right where it is, about a minute 18 into that particular piece, where you'll hear the CBS Radio Mystery Theater theme.
Oh, gosh, I'm not the only person who collects soundtracks.
And vinyl.
Yeah, even better. Part two of three parts. Let's get back to the CBS Radio Mystery Theater. Just a superior production to the old radio shows, because they had the advantages of technology and a better music pool, like Dave referred to. Let's enjoy part two and see if we can recognize that Twilight Zone music.
Teacher in a small grammar school explodes himself and the principal into what? He believes it's the world of the dead, but could he be someplace else? Some in-between state? It is a land where everything is shades of gray and green. Remember, it was a green powder that caused all this, a fact that does not escape those left behind.
Were you able to get any sense out of the boy, Dorothy?
Well, Billy says it was a green powder he found, brought it to class, and his chemistry teacher blew himself up with it, and that he and the principal just plain disappeared, blown to bits, no trace of them, Jim.
A doggone part of it is, you'd think an explosion like that would make some kind of noise.
Oh, it knocked out a wall, but none of the children were hurt.
So Billy brought that green powder, huh? We could be in for a peck of trouble.
Do you really think so?
Our son brings an explosive to school. His teacher and the principal are blown away. They could hold us responsible.
They could?
We're his parents, and he's underage. I wonder which teacher it was.
Oh, Fred Plattner. You remember him.
They got Fred teaching chemistry? What does he know? No wonder everything went flowy.
Oh, he's such a nice young man, too.
I know that.
Now, promise you won't say anything to Billy tonight. He was very fond of Fred, too.
Don't, Fred. Please, don't.
Jim, wake up. Jim, what is it? Jim, wake up.
Oh, Dorothy, I had such a nightmare. I was dreaming.
Don't tell me.
Why not? It was kind of crazy.
I had a terrible dream, too, Jim.
Fred Plattner. He came right into this room, and he motioned for me to follow him downstairs.
Oh.
And then he took out a small medicine bottle with green powder in it and was trying to give it to me. And then suddenly, it was gone.
I saw him, too.
By the whole closet.
I mean, in my dream, he was standing by Billy's bed, and he had that same bottle in his hand, and he was shaking his head. And then I woke up.
Poor Fred. He was too young to die.
It was like he was trying to tell Billy something.
That's what Fred did to me in my dream. Made me feel he wanted to tell me something.
So, here I am, Fred Plattner. Or maybe I should say I was Fred Plattner. Now I exist in this other world, and I'm trying hard to get through to the world I've been blown out of. To those incandescent, phosphorescent shadows of people and places I knew. It's very frustrating.
Plattner, where the devil are we?
Gee, I wish I knew, Professor Lidget.
I was watching you before walking down that steep hill and stopping, and then you were shouting at some rocks.
Well, I was trying to get through to Jimmy Carson. No go. He can't hear me. There must be a way to communicate with our world. Cut through the invisible barrier that separates us.
Plattner, I think I'm getting a chill.
Well, it's sitting in one place, Professor Lidget. Give me your hand.
Yes.
Up you go. Now, we'll get ourselves off this cliff. Down there, it may be warmer.
Oh, thank you, my boy. I'll follow you. I don't think I valued you when you were teaching at Sussexville.
Yes, that's good. That's good. One step at a time. It's never as steep as you think. I'll have to tell you, Professor, I have no idea where we're heading. But at least we're moving, and that's the best way to keep warm.
Plattner, you know what's even more terrifying? I can hear you. You can hear me. But that's all. There's no sound in this place. The leaves are moving, but no sound. The wind is blowing. You can feel it, but you can't hear a thing. We came down this cliff, not one footfall, not a sound. It's all like some mad, silent movie. Not a sound anywhere.
Jim, will you see who's at the door? I'm just clearing away the breakfast dishes. Billy was late getting off to school today.
Honey, I've got to make tracks for work myself. Harry's been giving me the hairy eye lately, ever since that rumor went around town about Billy blowing up the school. Oh, all right. Hello, Sheriff. What can I do for you?
Good morning, Jim. May I come in for a few minutes?
Oh, sure.
Is Billy home?
Who?
Billy, your son?
Oh, yes. No. Billy's in school. He loves school. Wouldn't miss a day.
Now, maybe it's just as well.
Sit down, Sheriff. Can I get you some coffee?
No, thanks.
Who is it, Jim? What? Hello, Sheriff. What brings you here this early?
I'll get to the point. You all know about that explosion at the school?
Why, yes, I did hear something about that. Accident in the chemistry lab or something, eh?
We've been investigating, and I'm not so sure I can call it an accident.
Fred Flatner and Professor Lidgett have...
Yes, that's a shame.
We've questioned every boy who was in or near that class, Jim, and they all say the same thing.
Well, Billy didn't mean anything by it. Honestly, he didn't.
Dorothy, shut up. I mean, dear, let the sheriff tell us what's on his mind.
I intend to. The information we've gathered is that your son brought a green powder into the class laboratory, and it was that that caused the explosion.
A green powder? Well... Where could Billy have found such a thing? He never said anything about it to us, did he, dear?
Jim, I think we should tell the sheriff.
Well, there's nothing to tell.
You asked where your son could have gotten such a powder. Three boys were with him when they all went to the lime kiln. He found it there and put it in a bottle.
Oh, what three boys?
Ted Jacoby, Matthew Goodman, and Tommy O'Shea.
I know those kids. They'll say anything. You know how kids are. You're not going to believe the word of little kids, are you?
Unfortunately, we have no adult witnesses. But as we piece the story together, this was no ordinary school experiment.
Well, I don't see how you could hold my boy responsible for the mistakes of a teacher.
So far as you know, then, Jim, this whole story about Billy and the green explosive is untrue?
Absolutely.
Is this Billy's school satchel?
Yes, it is. Where did you find it?
In the chemistry lab, under one of the seats. I'll be straightforward with both of you. We found traces of a green powder inside. So, if you don't mind, I'm going to have to ask you, Jim, to come along with me back to the station house.
Well, I can't go there now. I'm due at work.
I'm afraid you haven't got any choice, Jim.
But what have I got to do with it?
The law says that since Billy is underage, you, his father, are responsible. I have to book you, Jim.
Book me? On what charge?
Accessory to murder.
Several days and nights went by in our green world. This particular morning when I awoke, large, strange snowflakes were dropping all over me. Green snowflakes. And then, for the first time, the stillness was broken by a sound.
Latner, did you hear that?
Ah, Bell. I think it comes from way down there in the gorge.
Let's get down there. Maybe there are people or someone who can help us. Oh, beautiful. Platinum, do you hear that?
Hear what?
The sound of our own footsteps. Things are starting to be a little bit more normal. And it's not so cold down here.
Look at those gray craters.
Will you look at that?
I never. A great stone building. There's an entrance. Let's go on in.
Wait a minute, Platner. Isn't there something wrong about it? Something peculiar?
Well, nothing more peculiar than finding any gray skyscraper in a green world.
It doesn't have any windows. It's like being inside a huge tomb. There are some flickering lights way down there. An altar.
Something's moving back there.
Where?
To the right of the altar. What looks like a
torch, burning a green flame.
Oh, yes, I see what you mean.
Now, follow along the walls where that strange writing runs around the side, all the way to the right. Snowflakes. Big as a balloon, moving up and down. Let's get closer and have a look.
No, I think I'll stay back here.
If I go forward, Professor, you'll be alone here.
Oh. Those large things. Their heads, floating heads, with sort of tails hanging from each one like giant tadpoles in the air. They don't seem to have faces.
One is turning around. It's got eyes.
The others are turning now, too. They do have faces. Let's look at them now. They're floating away.
Anyone here?
Something just flew into my face. Something cold.
It's one of them. Who are you? Who are you? Who are you? Who are you?
I don't think I can take much more of this.
Look back. What do you see?
I see the school.
Our school. The big assembly hall. And the boys are taking a test.
The midterms, that's what they are.
Well, will you look at that? Some of them are using a crib. A pony.
So they are cheating in a midterm. Flatner, make a note which boys are cheating.
Well, I don't see the school anymore. It's changing now. I can see a street. Yes, it's Main Street.
So it is. How can we see Main Street from here?
Because it runs right through us, this world, this dimension. So that's where they went.
Who went?
Those floating faces. They're hovering over the people walking on the street, see? Look, one or two following each person, watching.
Watching? Why are they there? They're watching the living. Flatner, where are you?
I'm here. I just don't want to look anymore.
Oh, what's the matter with you? You're crying.
I know what those watchers of the living are doing. I know who they are. There are two of them above my head, aren't there?
Yes.
A man's face and a woman's face. I know them. I know who they are.
The two faces over your head, you know them?
It's my mother and father.
H.G. Wells asks, who are these watchers of the living? Why do they so passionately watch those they have left forever? Is it that when our life is over and evil or good are no longer a choice, that we may still have to watch the consequences of what we began? If this is so, then certainly Fred Plattner and Professor Lidgett have not died, but have invaded that dimension which hangs over all of us. I shall return shortly with Act 3.
You can sing Smoke Gets in Your Eyes, but when it gets into everyone else's eyes and nose and throat, it's no musical matter. Your Lung Association says cigarettes are a personal health hazard, and secondhand smoke is offensive to all non-smokers.
Give us all a break. Let the Lung Association help you kick the habit. For your sake and for everyone's life and breath.
So they're saying smoking is bad here? Is that what I'm hearing?
Something like that, yeah.
Yeah. Who knew? Who knew?
Yeah, you know, it's kind of like when I did that thing where Kathleen was interviewing me as the fourth doctor, because there's like four out of every five doctors agree I was the fourth doctor, the one didn't agree. I'm kind of poking around. I said, do you have a match? He says, no, I don't smoke. He said, I say, good for you. I hear that's supposed to not be good for you.
Rumor has it.
Rumor has it. Hey, you know, I got to thinking here. which is always a scary thought.
Yeah, well, that's at least one of us has been thinking.
When did the term science fiction even come into effect?
Ah, I have an answer, I believe.
Okay, or go ahead. Least... I kind of looked it up, but let me go ahead.
Well, let me say it this way. I know the origin of the abbreviation sci-fi, so I'm going to defer to your story before I get to mine.
Okay. From what my quick little Google search did during the last segment, is the term science fiction was popularized, if not invented, in the 1920s by one of the genre's principal advocates, the American publisher Hugo Gernsback. The Hugo Awards, given annually since 1953 by the World Science Fiction Society, are named after him.
Ah,
that's why
they call him the Hugos.
That's why they call him the Hugos. And that came about in the 1920s. Is that anything close to what you had surmised?
No, because carefully I remembered that the expression sci-fi, the abbreviation for it,
right,
was actually believed to have been created by none other than one of my personal heroes, Forrest J. Ackerman, the editor of Famous Monsters of Filmland.
There you go.
He was in the car with his wife, Wen Dane. Her name is Wen Dane. And they were discussing science fiction, and they were playing around with words. And at that time in the 50s, the stereo hi-fis had become very popular. And by playing around, they came up with the expression sci-fi, because Forey did a lot of clever pun writing, similar to, you know, the EC Comics, similar to the old radio horror hosts.
Right.
Those kind of clever alliterations and puns and rhymes and things, and use of gory terms in a humorous way. So Forey Ackerman actually came up with sci-fi, it is believed.
So then leads me to my next question, Dale.
Mm-hmm.
If science fiction wasn't actually termed until the 1920s, probably, how did they categorize H.G. Wells' stories?
Adventure, possibly.
Ah. What they called them was scientific romance. That's what they called his story.
Ah. Uh-huh.
So,
I learned so much.
This could be so educational. I love it.
Yes. Yes. Erie House. Get your Erie House degree. That's right,
Fox. Right.
He mentioned Forey in the chat. He was followed along with the story, so... So yay,
yeah.
Hugo, and yay, Forey, for providing us with a great catchphrase for our beloved genre of science fiction.
Absolutely. And I think he's starting to figure out kind of what's going on now in our story. That's really making it interesting.
It is, and for this to have been written in 18, not 19, folks, kiddies.
Yeah.
1897.
Yeah, It just truly blows me away, the insight. That's why, you know, again, I allude to these guys were time travelers stuck in another time and made the best with what they had. You know, Wells and he made it in writing. Ben Franklin just lit it, just basically, and that kind of was the gist of his interview, was that basically I just did what I could to make myself as comfortable as possible in these times. And therefore, you know, I just almost seems like some of these people had to have the insight of the future to be able to even imagine these things.
Even people like Mark Twain with his story, Connecticut Yankee. It was that kind of a fanciful look at, you know, what might happen if someone went into another time.
True. And that would have been certainly before this story.
Yeah.
So
predated a little bit.
So very, very interesting thought. I hadn't even thought of bringing Mark Twain into it, but that may have been one of the first scientific type stories. And was that the first time travel story, you think?
I don't know. I think we debated that last time we did time travel. We'll circle back to that topic again because there's certainly more radio shows that are in and around or involved with some sort of time travel.
Oh, absolutely.
Both science fiction, comedy, and an unholy mixture of both, which we love here on Eerie House. But this is pure straight drama, and it's a kind of a terrifying tale to me because these guys are wondering, are they dead? What's going on? Why am I seeing these people? Why are they not seeing me?
And what are these things that are floating above our heads and everyone's head? These watchers of the living. And you know what? That's got to confuse them even more because here they were thinking that they may be dead, but yet he's got two watchers above his head.
Strange, strange, strange. Let's find out what's really going on inside the twisted but brilliant mind of H.G. Wells in part three of Watcher of the Living from CBS Radio Mystery Theater.
Let H.G. Wells continue his story. If human souls continue after death, then surely human interests continue after death. So these watchers of the living keep an eye on earthlings. Make note that this in-between land is green, the color of renewal, of continuation, of movement. Therefore, this island in space and time onto which our two men have stepped could be a moving platform. But to where?
How many days has it been, Platner?
No, how many times did I go to sleep and wake up? Six, seven, eight? I can't be sure.
We have only you to blame for this.
I seem to remember that it was you, Professor, who said, why don't you set a match to the powder?
Why do these infernal things have to hang around us? What have I done to them? Well, go on, get away from me. Go away. Do you hear me? I don't see how you stand these floating heads always following us, bumping us like balloons with faces.
I am trying to be calm and not let myself go, and you must do the same, Professor. I could just as easily lose my nerve, but how would that help me?
Listen.
They've stopped.
You're in a different spot than I am, Platner. Your mother and father are watchers.
I hope you never see your parents as I'm seeing mine. Not being able to speak to them and be understood. Not knowing whether they are real or shadows.
No, no. I absolutely refuse to be fingerprinted, and that's final.
You have a right to call your lawyer.
Where are the bodies? Where's Fred Platten? Where's the headmaster, Professor Lidgett? How can you be sure they aren't still somewhere, wandering about in shock, maybe, but very much alive?
If in over a week they haven't shown up.
Amnesia. Do you know what that is, Sheriff? If I were blown up in some ridiculous experiment, it would addle my brains, too. They're alive, I bet you, but they don't know who they are or where.
Well, that all may be true, but you're still responsible for what happened. Speak to the mayor if you want to, but you're not leaving here until formal charges are placed.
It had all changed between Professor Lidgett and myself. No longer will we have like mind in this limbo of the dead where there was no sunrise or sunset, where a green haze hung over vast cliffs and stone buildings without windows. We were enemies, and that didn't help.
The day I hired you for the school, I must have been mad, Platner. You got us into this. Now, what are we going to do?
Try to keep my head, for one thing. For another, I'm going to sit here and have another try at getting through to Sussexville.
You have a formula. How are you going to do it?
Concentrate. Mother, father, help me see our town. There. I can see right through that rock face.
The walls of the house, like glass. Well, Professor, you got your wish. There's Billy Carson and his mother. They're standing in the kitchen listening to the telephone. There's unhappiness written on her face.
I shouldn't wonder. That boy shouldn't be allowed out alone. He's a menace.
They're talking to someone at the police station. Mother, father, I want to see what is happening there.
Dorothy, honey, don't cry. They won't let me go home right now. I've called our lawyer. He's in court, but he'll get over here as soon as he can. Now, you just tell Billy what trouble he's caused. I don't know when I'll get home. I'll get there when I get there. That's all I know.
This way, Mrs. Vandermill.
I don't know what possibly could have come over that sales girl. I mean, to actually accuse me.
Now, Mrs. Vandermill, there's nothing I can do.
Maybe something did happen to fall off the perfume counter into my purse, but heavens, to say I was shoplifting. Me, Helena Vandermill, why, I own half this town. Why would I ever steal anything?
They did find some merchandise in your handbag.
Who is that man sitting over there?
He's in our custody. He's waiting for his attorney. Now, Mrs. Vandermill, if you'll kindly pay the fine, all the formalities will be taken care of.
Oh, Sheriff, you are the most understanding public servant in this town.
The fine, Mrs. Vandermill?
Oh, yes, of course. Now, how much will it be this time?
I'd say $50 would govern. Oh,
$50 it is. There you are. All I have with me is 20, so here are 3, and do keep the change.
Thank you, Mrs. Vandermill.
Yes, I'll be more careful next time and keep my bag closed.
Who was that?
The richest old gal in town, but I have to haul her in at least once a week. She can't help shoplifting.
Oh, why didn't you arrest her?
Oh, I couldn't do that.
Oh, why did you slip her fine in your pocket?
I keep it safe there. Understand?
Yeah, I'm beginning to. And how much would a little understanding cost me?
Mr. Carson, Jim. I knew you'd understand the way we do business around here.
I'm sorry I was a little slow. Let me see what I have in my wallet.
Crookedness in our town. I had no idea. Starting with boys cheating on their exams, all the way to the police taking bribes. Lidget and I had stopped talking. I was too tired one evening to keep my eyes open, and before I knew it, I was asleep.
Flatner, get up.
Huh? What's the matter?
Get up.
Oh, yes, certainly. Professor, what are you holding that rock in your hand for?
I'm not staying here any longer.
Well, how do you propose to leave?
You're going to lead me back to the exact spot where we entered this other world.
Oh, I don't know that I remember it.
Well, you'd better, if you don't want your head bashed in.
Professor Lidget, I understand the strain you feel, but what good will it do you to hurt me?
I don't care anymore. I've got to leave here.
All right. Let's start up this path and see if I can find the place.
Hello, operator. I dialed 555-1212, and I got a wrong number. Would you place the call for me, please? It's the mayor's office. It works every time. Good morning, Mayor. Not too badly. We made $260. 60 from the old klepto, and I nicked another citizen for the 200. All right, will you stop by, or shall I send the cash over to the town hall? Good. I'll put 130 in an envelope addressed to you and marked official business.
scene of conniving didn't escape me either. It made me wonder, did I really wish to return to the life I had grown up with? We climbed and finally reached a plateau which I thought looked familiar.
Is this where we first landed? Are you sure?
I'm as sure as I can be. You know, Professor, that world of ours, it's not what it's cracked up to be.
No, it isn't. But it's the only game in town.
And people aren't what they think they are.
Blattner, you're still carrying that glass bottle with some green powder.
Yes, I still have it. What's left? Why?
Nothing. Just thinking.
It's finally dawned on me why the watchers of the living have such unhappy faces. What goes on Earth is enough to make anyone sad. Greed. Deceit. The people you thought were honorable, people you respected. Even you, Lidget. You're much less of a human being than I thought you were. Much less. Lidget, what are you doing to that rock? Lidget, please. On Earth, lying sprawled out in the schoolyard, covered in scratches and bruises. I was alone. Professor Lidget didn't get back to Earth with me. I remembered running away from the professor, and then I tripped and fell. Yes, the powder must have exploded on impact, and here I was. It was getting dark in Dr. Bendener's office, and I remembered I'd come to see him for a physical.
Feeling any better, Mr. Plattner?
Yes, I am. I'm fine now, Doctor.
Had a little sleep?
Oh, not exactly. Just thinking about how my insides got all reversed.
Nothing's malfunctioning, you understand. Just exchanged. Are you up to getting yourself home?
Dr. Bendener, I've decided I don't want to be a lifeguard after all. I'm just not the swimming kind.
I didn't know there was any other kind.
Oh, there are lots of ways lives can be guarded. I'd like to think about that.
Think about what, Mr. Plattner?
What I ought to do now that I'm back.
Back? Go back to teaching. I think you should.
Oh, well, they say that those who can, do. And those who can't, teach. I think I can, Doctor. And there's an awful lot of doing that Sussexville needs. Maybe I'll just give it a try.
It so happened that Fred Plattner knew quite a lot about the shenanigans of several high town officials. And come election time, when Fred started talking, everyone also knew quite a lot. So it was hardly a surprise when an unknown schoolteacher got himself elected mayor of Sussexville. Not surprising at all. I'll be back shortly.
I'm lost and lonely, scared and sad, trembling.
Serving time in a state prison. It is estimated that there are at least 1 million cases of child abuse in America each year. Child abusers and their children can both be helped. Find out how. Write Prevent Child Abuse, Box 2866, Chicago, Illinois, 60690.
Please stop the hurt.
Of the Ad Council and the National Committee for Prevention of Child Abuse.
folks around Sussexville are still scratching their heads, wondering where Fred Plattner and Professor Litchett disappeared to for 9 days, and why the professor never came back. But Fred isn't telling anyone. Every now and then, though, he'll look up suddenly from his desk in the mayor's office, as if he was seeing someone he recognized. Call it an H.G. Wells fantasy, if you will, but who knows? Perhaps we are all being watched. Over there. Is that a shadow over your head? Our cast included Tony Roberts, Bob Dryden, Bryna Rayburn, and Gilbert Mack. The entire production was under the direction of Hyman Brown. And now, a preview of our next tale.
I took a few steps down the rough cobblestone alley. It was dim. A place where the sun couldn't get to. There wasn't a sound. The bustle behind me seemed to have vanished. I walked slowly along the twisting alleyway. Well, there were a few shops, but they were all closed. I don't know why I kept walking, but something seemed to draw me along. And then the alley turned, and there it was. A small shop, brightly lighted with candles. In the window were clothes, leather things, beads, spices. There was no name on the door, but I knew I'd found the Devil's Boutique.
This is E.G. Marshall inviting you to return to our Mystery Theater for another adventure in the macabre. Until next time, pleasant dreams.
Household oil there. E.G. Marshall shamelessly borrowing from Raymond's little farewell.
Yes. But Hyman Brown created the other program, I guess he can use it there too.
Why not? If it's your stuff, who better to rip off?
Nice little preview for the Devil's Boutique. I also a story I'm very well familiar with. A very wonderful story.
And, of course, that'll end up here.
Go ahead.
No, of course, that one will end up here at some point.
No, I just got to think about all the... How come I've been... listening to radio programs like this since before Mystery Theater was on. It was my dad that turned me on to this show, and I'm just thinking, since 1974, this has been on, and I've been collecting things before that. So, you know, probably just to me, it's just amazing that I didn't realize how many years I've been listening to and collecting old radio programs.
Well, it's a good thing you are. You're helping us keep this genre, you know, in the forefront as much as we can, because I think these stories are worth sharing. They're certainly worth enjoying, and it's a learning experience, not just the, you know, facts and figures that you present us, but some of the little sidebars and some of the, you know, the human parts of what we learn.
True. And there is always something, although Fogsbane doesn't like to be learned unto, there's always something you can learn after a story like
that. Yep, there is. And now, Eerie House Radio proudly presents a garrulous moral of the story.
With apologies to Gar. If you're going to travel into a different dimension, be sure to wear a bicycle helmet, or else you may not become a lifeguard. There you go.
Somehow that all makes sense.
Hey, and we do hope the best for our buddy Gar, who is once again down for the count. He will not be doing his show tonight, and was not even able to call in here. And he was kind of upset before we went on the air yesterday because of the three shows we had for the weekend. He felt we had the best one of the three. So not that there was anything wrong with what we had yesterday, but boy, oh boy, this was a very good show.
It was. It gets you thinking. And we wouldn't do that to Gar deliberately. Cut him out of a good tale. It fits our time frames for the running times of our show.
For being a little shorter, but still giving us plenty of programming, having the 45 minutes is about what we have in a mystery theater, that they're really more tailor-made for the Saturdays. So we didn't do it on purpose, buddy, but it just kind of, like you said, kind of fits it better. And
It do fit the programming, because it would be hard to get two of those or one of those in a full half-hour show, plus our ambient conversation in a two-hour slot like we have on Fridays.
Right, and I thank Foggs for his kind comment there in the chat. It says you're like Dave, old time radio Wikipedia Binkley. Thank you, Foggs.
He most certainly is, Foggs. You hit the nail on the head. This guy truly is a walking encyclopedia when it comes to old time radio, and that's awesome.
The only problem is, I don't carry my volumes in the correct order. That's the problem there.
That's okay. As long as they're in there, we'll fish it out. But due to our time format and only one full time, 45-minute show, we do have time for Wheel of Radio.
But there's some other business we have to take care of before that, Dale.
Oh yes,
we do, because they'll get mad if we don't work this in. We'll hear about it from the sponsor.
Oh my gosh, we have to pay the bills, don't we?
We do, yes.
So I guess we're going to hear a word from the Princess and the Pea Mattress Company. Hi, I'm Dale.
And I'm Dave.
And we're here for the Mattress Company of America.
Folks, do you have trouble sleeping at nights because of your beat-up old mattress?
Do you have more lumps in your mattress than you do in oatmeal?
Then you need to shove it aside and get yourself a Princess in the Pea mattress.
This mattress is so thick and plush that it comes with a 7-foot step stool.
And it's so smooth and plush that you're guaranteed to get a lump in your throat before you get a lump in your mattress.
And if you're so comfortable that you can't get up and down the ladder in time to make it to the bathroom in time, then you may want to consider that extra layer of protection.
Whether you're 7 years old or 77, why not consider adding that layer, the Princess and the PP pad?
That's right. With the added thickness and charcoal filtration, it will keep you drier than a baby's bottom all through the night.
And this pad can be replaced in the time it takes to say rubber baby buggy bumpers 8 times real fast.
So don't lose another sleepless night on your old mattress.
When you can spend a sleepless night on a new one.
Walk, drive, or take a bus to your favorite mattress place and get a Princess and the Pea mattress today.
And remember to add on that Princess and the Pea pad.
More fine products of the Mattress Company of America.
Warning, the new mattress will not cure insomnia. That's what this commercial is for. There we go.
Okay. I like it. Not bad for a cold read. That was an absolutely
cold read. That's right. You warmed it up real good there.
Dave wrote that while we were broadcasting. Can you believe it?
I don't.
He just killed the illusion. But but we do have time, don't we? For Wheel of Radio.
Yes, we do.
So if you'd like, and you're listening live, if you're listening in the archive, you're wasting your time. Call 646-3... No, not listening, you're wasting your time calling. 646-378-0264. Dial carefully.
Yeah, that's right. And because if you call during off hours, they'll just hang up on you.
Yes. And better yet, make a kid do it with a rotary phone. Watch the fun as they try to figure out how to work a rotary phone. Dialing 646 978-0264. That's the Erie House Hotline.
Do you have a favorite H.G. Wells story, Dale?
Yeah, I'm going to have to go with The Time Machine.
War
of the Worlds is a close second, but quite honestly, I think my opinion is colored by my fascination and love for the 1960 Time Machine film based on the H.G. Wells story starring Rod Taylor and Yvette Mimieux.
I talked about it at length here.
I do love that movie.
Yeah, I think that may be right because, you know, I've always been fascinated with time travel, and that probably was my first influence as well.
Yeah, it made it to television in the 60s and
right, because when I saw it,
so.
it was an afternoon movie, and I think they called it The Golden Rings. Because when they were on the table, they spun those rings and it told the story.
Yeah.
So for some reason, they renamed it The Golden Rings instead of The Time Machine for some unknown weird reason. I don't know, but they did.
Maybe that was a local thing because I don't personally recall that. I do remember, however, in about 1975, so the movie would have been about 15 years old. In 1975, I took my first date ever, to see The Time Machine at Sullivan Square when they had but one screen, I think, maybe two screens at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And they had re-released it, which I couldn't believe, and, you know, having just started really collecting and buying famous monsters and really delving deep into both horror and science fiction, my date acquiesced and joined me to see The Time Machine. And we actually watched the movie, unfortunately. No, not that it wasn't a good movie, but... No.
So did she see a future with you or the past?
I'm actually the one who broke it off for reasons I will not discuss
on
this show. I just...
Okay. My phone's kind of digging out on me at the second, so must be my internet connection. So maybe you should go over and pull the wheel there, Dale.
Oh, the wheel of radio, of course. Sure. I'll step right up here and give it a pull.
Around and around she goes, and where she stops, nobody knows.
Oh, did I get
it? You know, I've been watching you from the wings, and what did I tell you? I know that you go very far. Why, you could really be a star if you'll just put yourself in my hands.
Hold it.
What's the matter,
Joe?
What's the matter?
Stop the music. Girls, you've been wonderful, but you must be very tired.
Oh, no!
Just a minute. You may leave now. You may leave now.
So?
You may leave.
So, tell me something. What's the idea?
Well, Jimmy Durante, I'm tired of you flaunting these beautiful girls in front of my face. I've watched you all during rehearsals, and I'm just tired of it, that's all.
Well, I didn't think you cared.
Well, now you know it. I try to keep it a secret for years. I'm sorry.
But don't be sorry. I feel the same way about you. Now, the first time I went out with Lana, boy, it was kicks. And how Rita melted when she saw my bag of tricks. You all know about Margaret Truman, Swanson, and the rest. They tried to break my heart, but they wound up second best.
Why, the Marquis de Pillsbury tried to get me in his clutches. I'm glad I'd play the field, for now I'd be some duke's old duchess. You know, if you travel long enough on any road, you'll find it's true that somewhere it has an ending. And Jimmy, my trail ends with you.
Why, you and me, yes, I agree.
Would you give up that millionaire oil man if I told you that you could have me?
If you're really sincere.
So?
Oh, my darling, my dear.
I'm as ready as I'll ever be.
Holy good night. What about these cover girls that you have around you? Are you going to get rid of them immediately?
Say the word and you know all the others must go. 'Cause I'm as ready as I'll ever be.
When the loves of the century are written, Jimmy, our names will be on top.
Come here, Sophie, please.
Don't tease. Oh, Jimmy, after all these years, this is the first time you've ever kissed me.
I wanted you to know that you haven't lived in vain. Call Niagara and make reservations. Why, you're gorgeous. You're so heavenly.
I love you, Jimmy Dean.
I love you, Sophie T.
We're as ready as we'll ever be. 'Cause I'm the last of the red-hot mama.
Yeah! The daddy who will cool you down.
Now, if you mean it, what are you going to do about it?
Well, what am I going to do about it? We'll form a merger.
Yes?
Instead of a courtroom?
What?
We'll use the Club Durant.
Wonderful.
And instead of a judge,
well,
Mr. Eddie Jackson.
Oh.
Hey, do you take this woman for your red hot mama? Do.
Yeah.
And do you take this man to be your red hot papa?
Do.
Yeah. And will you love him when this man no longer sings the blues? Will you love him when he's worn out all his dancing shoes?
I love that man when he's down to his last trombone.
Uh-huh.
And maybe we'll have a swing band all our own.
And from now on at the Cover Girls, I'll never weep. I'll cherish you till you're just out here last week.
And forever,
we will keep our love alive.
And I now pronounce you Mr. and Mrs. Jive.
Yeah.
Oh, Mr. and Mrs. Jive.
Yeah.
We
haven't gone on our honeymoon yet, and he's taken over the show.
That does it. Come on. Let's get on with the celebration.
Yeah. Send us presents immediately. We're going steady. Thank you, Eddie. We're
as ready as
we'll ever be.
Congratulations, there is ready as they will be.
And just like that, we got things fixed righty-tighty.
Righty-tighty.
That's yep, right.
Good old Jimmy Durante and Sophie Tucker, the last of the Red Hot Mamas. And along with that was Eddie Jackson. Jimmy Durante always thought that Eddie Jackson was one of the trio of his that were a big, big, big Broadway hit. A vaudeville hit. They also hit Broadway, but big, big on the vaudeville circuit. Clayton Jackson and Durante. Clayton was a dancer. Jackson was a singer. Jimmy Durante was the jokester and the piano player. They did things like breaking up and setting pianos on fire during the act and things like that. Boy, did they go through a lot of pianos. And I think this was a clip from his television show. And his television show was filmed from his nightclub, the Club Durant. D-U-R-A-N-T, not Durante. And the story behind that is that the painter came to sign to paint the sign, and he didn't have enough money. It was paid by it cost for each letter, and he didn't have enough to pay for the final E, so it became the Club Durant.
Briago. I got to see a very cool special all about Sophie Tucker on it was a documentary. It was either on Netflix or Amazon Prime. I forget which. If anybody out there listening would like to listen to it, you should. She really was an intriguing character from early American entertainment.
It was, yep. But it's just about time to say goodnight for this portion, isn't it?
It is, and thank you, Fogsbane, and everyone else for listening today or in the archive. We'll see you next week while we're facing the weekend.
The castle lights are growing dim. There's no one left but me and him. when next we meet in Frankenstone. Don't come alone.
We'll see you next week, Friday, 7:30. And that is that.
There you go.
And there's two of me. It's creeping me out. Should have kept my big mouth shut. No one would have known been the wiser.
Well, you didn't. Yeah, that's okay. We got you back in, and that's the important thing. You know, the great thing is we had with Eclipse going, we have the ability to do it. What's funny is I was really getting a very strong digital signal, mm-hmm. which I think was my internet, but it wasn't because after you spun the wheel, I didn't hear you announce it where it ended.
Hmm.
And then all of a sudden I heard the clip. So it was another fun time, an interesting time with Blog Talk Radio. Thank you very much.
Yes, and they make the mistake of, after every show, asking what we think of Direct Connect, and I am going to tell them.
It's great when it works, but man, oh man, it's given you probably as much or more problem than it's given you solutions.
Well, it's not live stream, so at least it's still running.
That's true.
And between you and me, Dave, we can fudge our way through pretty much anything, I think.
I think we probably could. But it's always better to be here accompanied than it is to be holding on the fort by yourself. But either way, we could probably do what we have to do.
Yes. And I would love to chat more about invisibility in films, like The Great Invisible Ghost, a good PD movie, a lot of horror hosts have used, The Invisible Man we touched on earlier.
Yeah. With The Invisible Man, you've got not only that, but you've got the late 1950s UK series, and you have the David McCallum series in the 70s. You know what? I looked through Lux Theater to find some of the great horror films that might have been covered by Lux, and they aren't there. That's odd. You know, as popular as some of the horror stories were, that they didn't really cover those. Now Orson Welles did. He covered, he did an hour-long version on the Mercury Theater on the Air of Dracula and of Sherlock Holmes, but the Dracula is one of the few horror stories, stories that really got the full treatment. I take that back. There was a 1935 or 36 serial, Frankenstein, then 12 or 13 parts.
Yeah. Did we not play that one?
We did not. Sometime you almost need a whole week of, doing so many parts.
Perhaps a Halloween time coming soon. We'll see. You can be assured, though, that Halloween will be the Halloween season, the Halloween week, will be chock full of really, really good horror.
Yeah, and if we do that as well, there's always some wonderful comedies about around Halloween time and going to haunted houses and things like that.
Oh,
so
sure.
If we were able to take the week and do a lot of those, then that could be a lot of fun too.
And it could. David, as you know, got a lot going on in Castle K. The daughter's back from college, and you know I'm taking care of my wife through a little medical thing we got going on. So we're gonna wrap up the after party a little bit early.
No problem, and just invite everybody, if you listen before next week, tune in next week. As you alluded to, we're going to be facing the weekend with stories about faces.
That could be scary in some cases.
I get scared every morning when I look in the mirror.
I'm surprised that I'm upright.
I look in the mirror once a day, and then after that, when I don't, I just I know I look like George Clooney the rest of the day. So,
well, I know we already heard from Jimmy, but I think we need to hear from him again.
We do.
And thanks for listening. We'll see you next time here on Erie House Radio. Say goodnight, Dave.
Good night, Jimmy. Ta ta ta.
Good night. Good night. Good night. It's time to say good night.
have a good night. We've had a few laughs, and it's time for toodaloo. Arrivo, up we the same, and ink-a-tink-a-doo. Good night. Good night. Good night, folks. And good night, Mrs. Calabash, wherever you are.